AdYak.
You're listening to AdYak. AdYak is the official podcast of the AAF Greater Lehigh Valley Ad Club. Our mission is to inspire creativity and enhance the professional development of the advertising and marketing communities where we live and work. I'm your host, Bill Childs, and I'll talk with artists, designers, writers, directors, photographers, along with those who work in a creative capacity. Our aim here is to serve as a creative resource to help you stay informed, entertained, and above all, inspired. But first, I want to thank ASR Media. We appreciate your support and collaboration.
Welcome back to AdYak, the podcast where I pull on the threads of creativity until something unravels. And today's episode went deeper than I expected, in the best way possible. I sat down with filmmaker Brandon C. Lay, whose new film, Finger Lace Crown, follows a spray paint artist named Lemon Drop as she navigates both her creative passion and the high walls of the fine art world. The film officially dropped on streaming platforms, Prime Video, Fandango at Home, and Hoopla on December 5th, 2025, after making the rounds through local premieres and landing a distribution deal with Buffalo 8. It's already picking up recognition, including Best Foreign Feature at the Unrestricted View Film Festival. In our conversation, Brandon opened up about the sacrifices artists make, the kind that don't show up in the behind-the-scenes footage. We got deep into his writing process, how he works with actors, the filmmakers who shaped him, and the movies that made him want to pick up a camera in the first place. He also dropped some great advice for young filmmakers. So whether you're making films or just trying to make anything that matters, you may want to listen to this one. What really stayed with me was the meaning behind Finger Lace Crown. It's not just the name of the film. It was a revelation. One of those moments that lands softly but stays with you. And once you hear it, you'll understand why. Here is my AdYak with Brandon C. Lay.
So I just got done watching the movie about an hour ago.
Nice.
And
okay, great.
I loved it, man. I did. I loved it. Like the art direction, the shot selection, the writing, the story. It was fantastic.
I really appreciate that. Thanks a lot. Yeah, it's been a little while since it's been completed, but it's finally getting out to people, and we're getting a lot of reactions like that, which I really appreciate.
Your cast is amazing, especially the main actress. Really, really phenomenal. Really phenomenal.
Yeah, Therese, she is. She's fantastic. We've been working together for a while. I want to say 5 or 6 years on again, off again. Like, we don't work on everything together. She does a lot of like theater and as well. And then that's how I saw her first. I saw her at a collection of, like, I believe it was one acts written by women. Mm-hmm. And it was in like the basement. Not really basement, but like a gathering area in a church, but it was in like the lower level. Calling it a basement sounds weird. It was just like slightly like you walk down some stairs and it was like a communal area.
Yeah.
And there was a stage in there. She was doing that. And I was working on something at the time. And my friend Sid Stauffer, who was also in the film, Sid and I went and saw her in that production because we were interested for a part. So we kind of wanted to like scope her out a little bit.
Sure.
And that was years and years ago now.
Really? Wow.
Yep. Therese, she's amazing.
So where'd you get the idea for the story? What's the thought there? Where did that come from?
Yeah, that one's from the artist Tyrone. He is the artist behind the character Lemon Drop's work, like the backdrop of everything. That's his art studio, or was his art studio back when Banana Factory still existed.
Oh, yeah.
It's been I think, torn down within the last 6 months to a year or so. I know they're building up something new. It's like on the other side of the bridge for me. But yeah, that was his studio. And so this would have been, I want to say 2022, give or take. I want to say 2022. He'll correct me if I'm wrong. Anyway, Tyrone is this amazing spray paint artist, and he was entering into the world of NFTs, which was like a real thing at that moment. Like, it was a real, like, similar to how aggressive the conversation is over AI right now. It was the same kind of thing with NFTs about 3-4 years ago, whatever it was. And he was like right on the pulse of it for a little while. And his work was being turned into NFTs, and he was making some real serious headway with it financially. And but he was telling me about it and how some people would want the original real artwork, the stuff that you actually made, destroyed, so some digital version of it would be worth more money.
I know that,
which for me, especially when I first hear it, was forget about it. No way. Yeah.
That part got me with Dan Roebuck. When Dan Roebuck says, I look forward to more of your work, I was like, oh my God. Yeah, it was just a great line. I look forward to your work.
That was his. That was an ad-libbed one. Got to work through that scene and everything like that, which is really great. Dan is a really funny guy. Like, and he leans to his instincts as a performer lean towards the humorous.
Hmm.
And so, you know, I could tell he really wanted to sell that line at the end. And I was just like, yeah, I'm digging it. I'm down. Let's have that in there. It's a great little button to this moment of this bittersweet moment for her dealing with, you know, what this art scene is like for her.
So
that's where it kind of came from, was Tyrone was really dealing with that, and he was, you know, it's his story to tell as far as like what he was going through, but it was like an overnight change in his life, in the positive, like all in the green, all of a sudden, just because of him being having another avenue to sell his artwork in. And and then from there I was just like, well, I love his work. And, you know, and this battle in me, like trying to see how I felt about it, you know, and part of it, you know, it's not something that I'd want done with my work. However, part of what I came to is there is something beautiful about that destruction, in the same way that like theater is beautiful. It only lives for the people that go to see it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. And so there is something to be said for storytelling and art that works that way. Now, the fact that it's being filtered through technology is a different thing. Like, that's a much bigger conversation. That was part of how I made my peace with it at the time. And then it was just a great avenue for me to be able to explore, you know, a coming of age story for this woman on that backdrop.
You don't know what you want. At 23 years old, you don't know what you want.
Don't you say that. Don't you say that. I have always known what I've wanted, and I've gone after it. I didn't have rich moms to fall back on. I was raised in a one-bedroom apartment with a curtain separating my bedroom from the living room until I was 13 years old. If I didn't know what I wanted, I'd get jack shit. Don't tell me that I don't know what I want. I have made it blatantly clear from the go that I wanted you. And I haven't wavered from that for a second. I haven't risked anything. I have nothing. I have nothing but my heart. And I have worn it on my goddamn sleeve for you.
Everybody that was in it just did a phenomenal job. I was very impressed with that.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, I'm super proud of my cast.
I love the shot selection for a lot of the scenes. It just are just like, man, they almost like, were you trying to go for like kind of like a painting in a sense? Like because the colors were very vivid. They're very, you know, bold.
Absolutely.
Vivid, which I really liked. And I love character studies. I love movies that are like small and intimate and just people reacting to each other, and we don't get a lot of those movies anymore. You know, the 70s was kind of like when that the heyday of that. I think of like the John Cassavetes of the day, you know,
for sure.
Character studies where it's just like, you know, it's not so much about, you know, CGI and explosions and all that other stuff. It's more just human. I love that. That's what I like about it.
I appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, I gravitate to towards those kind of stories myself, obviously. I mean, that's why I make them.
Yep.
I mean, part of it's budget, but I really don't have an interest in big action set pieces and stuff like that. Like, I like action, don't get me wrong, but I like everything to be a little bit more grounded. And so there's a few special effects shots in this, but they're really like old school style of special effects, where it's like the same way that someone would use a matte painting back in the day, where they would be like layering film shots.
Yes.
You know, I'm doing some similar things just like in a modern way.
Yep.
Like, I'm not actually having matte paintings for the background, but similar kind of like screens and like shifting perspectives like that.
I kind of want to go see now the rest of your movies.
Oh, great. Please do.
That's kind of like where I'm at. Like, I wait for this one and I'm like, now I want to, I remember, you know, The Worry Doll, right? And Macy on a, or Gracie on a Good Day. I hope I'm getting that right. They were in my...
You were right the first time. Yeah, Macy.
Yeah, they were. I remember when they came out, but I just, you know, for whatever reason, I didn't connect with them to see them. But now I kind of want to. Now I want to go back and where can I check out the catalog? Like, is it available anywhere?
For me? Yeah, so there's a couple ways to see some of them. Yeah, so Macy on a Good Day, The Worry Doll, and The Ground That Sinks are all available on Amazon still. I mean, we don't really promote them any longer or whatnot. Like, it's funny too, because like I'm working with much better equipment now. So by no means am I not proud of these pieces of work, like performances, the writing, super proud of all that, even how I shoot things. But what I'm shooting with and the equipment and things like that have gone forward so much that I do give people that heads up because, you know, it's, there's a 10-year difference on some of them, you know? So and now instead I've gone into mountains of debt in order to have camera equipment that would like actually be able to accomplish what I'm trying to accomplish. But yeah, so you could see those there. A lot of the short films are available on Vimeo. And if someone really was into what we do, we have a Patreon. And on Patreon, if you're a subscriber to like at the library pass tier, then everything's available to you. It's just like you can have a link to literally any one of our films that we've done in the past. None of the stuff that's out yet, but like any of the stuff that's been around. Yeah.
Okay. So then what's the process then? You submit this to festivals and things like that.
Mm.
So have you done that yet with this new one?
So there's a couple. Yes. So the best example of like going that route with things was Bitter Taste of Ginger, which was the film that we made before Finger Lace Crown, which is a much darker piece. It's more satirical. It's very, very dour in a good way, like in a fun kind of like intense, but it's not, definitely not for everybody. But it was also our most popular piece that we made. It was you know, a much more sledgehammer kind of piece. It's only an hour and 15 minutes. So it's as short as a feature can be and still be considered a feature. And that one we submit all over the place. Like every bit of energy was getting it out to festivals and doing the festival circuit. And I stopped counting after I think 30, I want to say. And, you know, it took a whole bunch of awards at the festivals. The lead actress, who's also in Finger Lace Crown, she plays Sammy, Sarah Cugini, just like was just Santa bag level of awards for her performance. And deservedly so. She's amazing. As did ensemble awards. And we did really well on the festival circuit with that. However, we did not have any form of distribution or anything like that. So with this one, we went a completely different route. With this one, it was more about, okay, can we get distribution? How do we go about doing that? And then what does that path really like look like at this stage of being an independent filmmaker? And with Bitter Taste of Ginger, one of the people that saw it at a festival was a gentleman named Glenn Reynolds, who with Circus Road Films, and he is a distribution consultant. And he reached out to me about Bitter Taste of Ginger, loved it, and was like, but I got to be honest with you, Brandon, I think I only have about a 50% chance of selling this for you. And I just loved his honesty so much that like he could be making money for me right now or trying to, and instead is like, you know, I love your work, but you can hire me if you want, but I don't want to give you like a definite. And then when we finished this piece, I reached back out to him. It was like a year and a half later. And he was like, fantastic. What are we going to do with it? You know, what do you want? And so I hired him. We hired him. We are, when I say no budget, I mean literally no budget. Like, everyone's a volunteer. Everyone's doing what they can. Like I mentioned before, mountains of debt to get professional equipment. But like, there's no real money behind us. It's all like, what can we make from nothing? So we raised his fee, which was in large part accomplished by Felicia White, who plays the mom, Lynette, in this, and also Joshua Fatoros, who plays Baby in this. Josh is a business owner, and between him and Felicia, they did a lot of the legwork raising the funds. I did some work raising the funds. The whole team did, but the two of them especially. And then, yeah, we went with him, and he got us in touch with Buffalo 8 and many others. We selected Buffalo 8 of the ones that made offers to us. And now fast forward to now, and, you know, we're actually coming out, you know, and it's not all my legwork as it has been for a lot of the others, which is an exciting step. Yeah.
That's awesome. I love to hear that.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this then. So when did this... When did this all begin? Your love of film, your love of movie making. Where did this group in your life?
Sure. We can go two routes with that. I mean, I've always loved film. My dad and his best friend, my Uncle Jeff, before I was born and when I was really young, I think it was all before I was born, used to make films on like Super 8 and things like that. And there's been, like, it's in my blood, not necessarily making films. My Uncle Jeff was more the person behind the camera. My dad was in front of the camera. But beyond that, a love for film was ingrained for me from birth, you know? My grandfather loved movies and was a bit of a shut-in because of how much he loved movies. My dad loves movies. My mom loved movies. And it's so interwoven with that aspect of my life, you know, not to get too personal about it, but, you know, like when my parents were divorcing, you know, I was a teenager and it was this like unifying thing. Like I went to see these kind of movies with my dad. I went to see these kind of movies with my mom. I went to see these kind of movies with my cousin Mark, who was babysitting me, you know, and it was an escape, but also like even from a young age, it wasn't just like viewing it as entertainment for me. It was viewing it as like, oh, this is this person's tastes. Someone created this tone. It's not just the actors on the screen. Like someone's behind all of this, you know?
Sure.
And I remember very specifically, I must have been like 5 or 6, something like that. And when my dad used to watch movies, if it was something more adult, if it was a Woody Allen film, or if it was, you know, something with a lot of violence or whatnot, something that I wouldn't understand at 5 or 6, he would say things like, oh, this is a boring one. You're not going to like this one. And I'd go, oh, okay. And I'd leave and go play with my toys. And I remember so vividly that one of the times he did that, I still remember, it's at the end of Witness, the Peter Weir film.
Yeah.
With Harrison Ford, and Danny Glover is the villain in it, and he's like walking through like these warehouses for corn or wheat or things like that. It's like right at the climax of the movie when it's going to get really, really violent.
Yep.
And I sat down in front of the TV to watch with my dad, and he paused it and was like, I didn't pause it yet. No, he was like, oh, this is a boring talky one. You won't like this. And I went, that's okay. Like, cause I just wanted to spend time with my dad. And he went, oh, and paused it because he lied. And my dad never used to lie to me ever lied to me. And it clicked in my brain like, oh, movies have the power to make my dad lie. You know, like as weird as a thing that sounds, but like I still remember it to this day.
That's powerful.
I remember his sigh.
Yeah.
You know, I remember his sigh. I remember him having to stop the climax of a movie because it was going to be violent when he tried a different route to get me out of the room and it didn't work. And it's so many little things like that growing up when movies are treated both literally and unintentionally with power, you know, that sinks in. You know, storytelling was always a big part of my household. My dad was a writer. My mom was an artist, you know, and, you know, so from a very young age, like that became like I've always wanted to be a storyteller and always have been, you know, and, you know, I wanted to do acting as well. And I love acting, but I don't trust somebody else behind the camera, you know, so I stopped acting in my own movies. I mean, little bits here and there, but and then I truly and honestly fell in love and prefer the actual like crafting of the story itself through my words and through working with actors and shooting it and editing it. Like I just fell in love with every aspect of that.
What are some of your favorite movies?
Oof. Let's see. Well, the Letterboxd 4 on there right now are Rashomon, Cries and Whispers, Hannah and Her Sisters, and There Will Be Blood. Those are the four that I have.
Those good ones.
But I have my list of 100 too.
Yeah, right. Sure. Okay. I like that. Who are who are some directors you admire?
Oh, okay. Well, from that list, we got Kurosawa, we got Bergman, we got Woody Allen, and we got PTA. All four masters, as far as I'm concerned. Both for most of them, Kurosawa wasn't really a writer, but he was a storyteller through the filmmaking. He did some writing, but his real gift wasn't necessarily the writing portion of things. He adapted a lot of things. Yeah. But in the case of Bergman, for sure, Woody Allen, for sure, PTA, for sure, all writer directors, all people that are taking their words and the story that they are writing, which on itself, by itself, without the visuals, is already a totemic piece of work. And then when you add in the collaborators and the visuals and how good they are at expressing whatever it is that they're going for, it just doesn't get any better. Just doesn't get any better.
Cassavetes make that list or no?
I like Cassavetes. I like Cassavetes. I mean, I've seen everything, just about everything he's done. Woman Under the Influence, I adore. Opening Night, I adore. And I respect his process quite a bit. And I love how he works with actors. I don't think much of him as a writer. Like when I think of Cassavetes, I'm not thinking of him as like, oh man,
right, right.
The writing of Cassavetes. And like, I'm a writer first. And so I've absorbed and like, you know, one of our godfathers of independent cinema, you know what I mean? Like in America, you know, sure. I love the guy, but he's not on my Rushmore. Like he's not one of my main guys. Yeah.
Got you.
But you love him.
I was thinking, I think the first time I don't know if I actually met you, but I was in the same room you were in, was at George Miller's house.
Okay.
George Miller used to stage readings like on a Sunday evening at his farmhouse, and Kate, his wife, and
yeah,
we would all get parts to read. That was so amazing for me to be a part of that, because I'm not, you know, but like, I love words. I love, you know, I love plays. I appreciate the craft immensely. When I got to sit in on those things and like, and listen to people read some of their plays that they're working on. And I know that you were at one or two of those. And I think George was the one.
I was at a bunch for a while. Yeah.
Yeah. George was the one that first said to me, you should check out Brandon's films. They're really good. And I think it might have.
Oh, well, that's so
sweet. Which one it was. Yeah. And I was, yeah. Well, of course, I love George Miller. I mean, you were at his wake. You were filmed. Like you were there filming.
Yep.
You put a whole piece.
I did. Yeah.
Yeah. And he cast my son in To Kill a Mockingbird to play Dill.
Okay.
When Oakes Fegley got cast to go be in Boardwalk Empire.
Okay.
Right. So he goes off to HBO and Brooklyn or where they're shooting that. And now he had everybody cast for To Kill a Mockingbird and he had no one for Dill. And my son was doing things with Civic and, you know, he was kind of like known through there. And yeah, George cast him. It was the last one that he cast. And it was, what a play that was at the PA Playhouse. I mean, Mary Badham came to the opening night show, which was crazy.
So. I mean, I've heard so much about that show. I did not see that show of George's.
It was like a
who's. But that's all I hear.
Yeah, like Roy Shuler, you know, was in it. Surprised Dan Roebuck wasn't in it. He probably wasn't available at the time, or he would have probably been in there somewhere. But no, George, I miss George so much.
Agreed.
But yeah, we're in each other's presence for the first time.
Yeah, I mean, I was at a bunch of those. I remember that. So this would have been in 2010 or 2011-ish. Mm-hmm. I didn't know George yet.
Mm.
And George and Kate moved back from Ireland.
Yep.
Back to the Lehigh Valley. And that was a big deal for a lot of people. For me, it was just, cool, more cool theater people, you know? And I didn't really know many people in the theater community that well. I had gone to Northampton Community College and done theater there.
Okay.
And there was this small theater in Nazareth called the Insomniac Theater.
Hmm.
And this is leading to George and Kate. So at Insomniac Theater, some of the people in Northampton Community College were doing work there. A gentleman named Charles Weigold,
yeah.
Who unfortunately passed away a few years ago. And Charles and I went to college together, and he was a talented director and, you know, was always spoke highly of me, both of my work as a writer, but also a director. And so they were looking to put on new plays there. So I had rented the space and did a couple things there in the small theater, like hallway small. And a gentleman there, and whose last name it was like, it started with an M. I want to say it was like a Marlowe or an elderly gentleman. Mm-hmm. Bill, also a Bill. He too passed away, but many years ago now. But he loved my work. Like he came to every single thing. I had no idea who this gentleman was. Like almost everyone in the audience was someone I knew. And he came to it because Insomniac was doing something. Maybe he just supported their work there and then just started coming to everything I did there. And he was the one that emailed me and told me, like, you really need to meet my friends, Kate and George, who just came back from Ireland. And they were doing a reading of plays at Donegal Square at Red Stag in the upstairs.
Yep.
And so I went to the first one of that. And here I am, this 20-something whatever, you know, I'm coming in. Like people are reading like one acts or like scenes that they're working on. And I come in with like my stack of finished plays. Like at that time I was banging out a full length play, like once every month, every other month. Like I was just really churning them out. And I'm not exaggerating. Like I was just like, it was just like, I could not stop and just mm-hmm. kept going. And, you know, at that time I really felt like I wasn't getting the opportunities that I wanted, whether it be at college or, you know, I grew up really poor. I didn't have real money to like really make things happen for myself. All I could do is work, which is what I did. Yep. And I came in with a play, like the best one of the lot was called Panther Piss. And I gave it to George and Kate and was like, hey, you know, I would love to have my work read at one of the next ones. And, you know, this is for your consideration or whatever.
Yeah.
And I would say 2 weeks later, I received a call from George and Kate, and George was weeping on the phone telling me how much he loved this play. And this isn't me coming from like a bragging standpoint. I'm saying it more as like how loving of a man George was. You know, and for as young as I was, you know, my parents liked my work, my friends liked my work, things like that. But this is someone who's been doing theater for longer than I've been alive, you know, who has no reason to be nice to me and is effusively telling me how much he loved this play. And, you know, praise like, you know, can't believe my age, like all the things you want to hear in your very early 20s, you know, from someone who's been doing this as long as they have. And Kate, like, the phone from him a couple times to also effusively tell me how much she loved it, but yeah. Also in a more like trying to be in a controlled way, because George was, as George could get sometimes, he was kind of like a blubbering mess at the moment. It was like, and like, it's one of the things I love about him. I loved when he was really moved by something.
Yeah.
And I say that, of course, with all love. And they were like, yes, we would like to read scenes from this at the next thing. And they actually did like a full performance, like reading at, Touchstone. And it was the first time that like something of my work like sold out a house, and you know, it had Kate acted in it, Pete Sanchez acted in it. My first girlfriend, who was like still my dear friend, Laura Krompasik, acted in it, and also Bob Wieck. And it was like a four-person play, and it was one of the best early experiences of my life as a creative. And that was George and Kate. And then I was going to those readings that you were talking about pretty consistently. They had about one a month, the Selkie sessions. I met a lot of wonderful people through them there.
Oh, yeah. They had really cool, really cool setup. What was the film that you would say kind of did it for you, that was like, that just sunk in? I mean, was it the Peter Weir movie?
Oh, like for me, like what broke through?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, there's been a lot of different films at different points in my life. Like it really shifts depending on, like, there's never been just one film. It's always been the film at this stage in my life. Like when this one hits in one way or another. I would say the most important shift in my work and me as a person and as an artist was when I discovered Bergman. And that came about because of being raised seeing Woody Allen films and loving Woody Allen films. And then this is one of the things I would recommend to anybody that's like really in love with the craft, is what filmmakers do you like? Then you watch their interviews, not just their film. You hear who they praise. And then you go watch those people's films. Mm-hmm. And you follow the lineage of the artists you respect. And by doing that, through Woody Allen, I got to Bergman. And when I started watching Bergman, I was at a real down part in my life. And I was, as mentioned, like incredibly prolific, but there was a sense in me of like, what does it matter? Like, I'm not going to get anywhere with this. Like, it's not, there's been so many artists better than me who have been, who said anything I have at all interesting to say better than I'm ever going to be able to say it in my head in my 20s. And for whatever reason, I decided I'm going to watch Ingmar Bergman's films in order. I'm not going to start with Wild Strawberries. I'm not going to start with Fanny and Alexander. You know, I'm going to start way, way back. The ones I don't even remember the titles are, because they suck. They're just bad. They're not good. And like, I'm saying that as a devout Bergman fan. I do not like his early work. I think they're beneath him. And I think that some of them are trying to be comedies and they're not funny. Like, there's like really was nothing of value in my eyes at that time. I'd probably feel differently now. I have a much different palette now. But in my 20s, I was like, this is useless. What am I doing? And then they started getting better. And I was like, oh, okay. Well, I guess I kind of get it. Me being an arrogant 20-something, like, oh, I guess Bergman's okay. And then I got around to Virgin Spring. And I went, oh, okay. Well, this is a masterpiece. There's a moment in it where Max von Sydow, after his daughter has been killed, when he goes out to a tree, it's this small tree, and he like tears it from the ground, and it's just a continuous shot. And I remember so vividly watching that, and like I painted my own backstory to all of it. Bergman didn't write any of it. Like I'm there. Oh, he planted that when his daughter was born. That's why he's doing this. And that, like, the movie didn't tell me that. I told me that. And and then he proceeds to, spoilers for Virgin Spring, a movie that's more than 60 years old. He proceeds to kill the people that he's a religious man, and he proceeds to kill the people that brutalized his daughter. And he kills them after inviting him into his home as a religious man. And he even kills the little boy that was with them. And that's the, like, he kills the boy. And I'm like, what do you mean he killed the boy? No hero in a movie kills the boy. And it's like, no, he's in a rage. These men and the boy was there, and the boy didn't do anything about it.
Yep.
He kills everybody. Yep. And I was like, I was so blown away by that film. And then I was like, okay, I'm in for the ride now. Bergman's the man. I get it. And then it just got to a point where it was just like one masterpiece after another. Like,
yeah,
it's like some of the, it was the best films I had ever seen at that time. And when I got to Cries and Whispers, still one of my, you know, all-time favorite films forever, I was like, I don't know that a movie gets better than this. Like, for when it was made, the performances in it, the writing, how it's shot, like, everything about it, I was just like, oh, this is where we peaked, right here, at Cries and Whispers. And then he had a couple more after, like, and then Fanny and Alexander, I was just like, so Bergman for me was the guy. And the reason why it was that time, because at that time, the thought about quitting wasn't a real quitting. There's the quitting of I'm never picking up a pen again, and it wasn't that. It was the I give up of I have stuff to say, and I'm never going to be able to say it. And it turned it around so completely for me, where it was like, oh, I'm nowhere close to my Cries and Whispers. I'm not even at my Virgin Spring yet. I'm still making the movies that some arrogant 20-year-old 50 years from now might be like, I don't get Bergman, that Brandon C. Lay guy. You know, it's like, it was such a powerful hit to my ego, but in a loving way. It was in a way of like, hey, dude, it's okay. It was almost like me now, or me 10 years from now, even coming to my younger self and being like, dude, you should be having these thoughts 20 years from now. Like, right now is the joke. Like, it's okay. Make your bad little movies, write your bad little scripts. It's fine. You're on your way. Keep going.
Part of the process. It's all part of the process.
All part of the process.
And if you're an artist, which it, you know, you are, and I'm hearing you feel things very deeply. You get affected.
For sure.
Things very deeply. I mean, that's kind of the double-edged sword of being the artist, right? Like my one friend said to me, Bill, he said, the greatest thing about you is that you feel things so deeply, and you just, your life is just so amazing to you, and you can be so impressed and blown away by the simplest things. I said, yeah, I kind of feel that. He's like, do you know what the worst thing about you is? I'm like, no, you feel things very deeply. And I was like, And that was the first time anyone ever kind of explained that to me, and that where it made sense, because it was like, yeah, there's sometimes you can, you know, I wouldn't want to be any other way than I am, but I know that there's people that probably don't feel things the way artists feel things, and I don't know if they're happier, because sometimes, you know, a lot of this stuff that we have to sit in or sit with, it's a lot. It can be a lot, you know? Do you consider yourself, are you an overthinker?
Oh, as a person? A person, yes. Okay. I'm the right amount of thinker as an artist.
There you go.
When I'm doing artsy things, I'm the right amount of thinker. When I'm a person going day to day, like going to the bank, I'm definitely an overthinker.
Yeah. Interesting. All right. So that's cool. So what advice would you give to a young Brandon Lay starting out? What would you say to him?
I would probably say it is going to be so much harder than you think it is. It's going to be so, you're going to sacrifice so much more than you ever think you're going to. I would, frankly, a young me, I would try to do everything I can to dissuade giving as much of it as I know I did. But I also know the young me, like the old me, would be like, too bad. you know, and still go and do it, yeah. You know? So like, if it were really me, to me, I would give like little advice that would have been huge, which would have been, start sooner. Go at it harder, faster in the beginning, like right away. I would say there was a real shift in my work when I got professional equipment, and I could have done that sooner and should have. Mm-hmm. I did not realize that I could have made those waves happen. So I would have told myself, the second the Blackmagic 4K camera comes into existence, mm-hmm. it is affordable. Get it. Buy a 35 millimeter lens and stop using your DSLRs, because I would have been shooting much more professionally 4 or 5 years earlier. If I were talking to young people in general, I would say watch more films and watch better ones, because the ones you're watching are not good. No offense, but watch better ones. Here's a list, you know, and I'm not going to have you do Bergman right away. You know what I mean? Like, there's tiers, and like, start here with the filmmakers you like, and then those people like these people, like I was talking about before.
Agreed.
And follow that lineage. No, I don't think, like, I saw Rashomon in film school, and I thought it was good, but I didn't get all the fuss. I rewatched it like 3 or 4 years later by my own choosing, and went, oh, this is the greatest film. It's just the best. I get it. Okay. You know, you will age, and the work will age differently for you. You know, it will be different for you. So that's part of it. The other thing too is, and you know, this comes with that other advice, is one of the things that's being lost in film right now is blocking and camera movement. It just doesn't exist.
Right.
And it's come from, 10 years now or more, it's been more like 20 almost now, but especially bad in the last 10 years of prestige television. We have so many good shows out there. They're great. The writing's great. The performances are great. They can tell the story as long as they need to. And unfortunately, that's being stretched out too much. But the problem is the first episode or two will be directed by a real like auteur director, and they'll be fantastic in some kind of way. And then what you'll find, and that most audience members aren't even noticing, mm-hmm. is then they start getting shot reverse shot. The second you see two people standing in a room talking to one another, people in real life do not stand in the center of a room and talk to one another. It does not happen. I could probably maybe twice in, I'm going to be 40 in 1 month, exactly, practically. In my 40 years, maybe twice in my life have I stood in the center of a room with another person standing in the center of a room talking to one another, you know? And that has been the majority of what TV shows have become. So the first thing I would tell young people picking up a camera, the first thing I would tell a young me, someone that actually wants to do this, the first thing you do to stand apart is just move your people around. Just give them reasons to go places, give them business, make them eat cereal, make them have to get cereal, make them have to clean up a stain on the floor, give them business. People don't stand in the center of a room and right. do anything other than a shot reverse shot. Now, not a shot reverse shot can be great. Some of the best movies ever made rely heavily on shot reverse shot. I'm not saying don't use it. I'm just saying it can't be the only tool in the tool shed.
Right.
It's right. last resort kind of stuff. You know?
Yeah.
There's a lot of it in Finger Lace Crown, you know, but it's just not the only thing that we are employing. So that'd be what I'd be telling people.
I love the way that film looked. The Finger Lace Crown, the look of that movie was just, it's exquisite. Like it's, what camera were you using? Are you this full K?
Yeah. So thanks. I really appreciate that. So you asked earlier if we were going for like that painterly kind of look, and that's a big thing about it. It's like, you know, somebody said this, somebody smarter than me at one point in time said, you know, every piece of art you make is in response to the last piece of art you made. And I don't remember what kind of art they were talking to. They might have been talking about film, probably, because that's mostly what I'm ingesting. But and so Bitter Taste of Ginger was so dark.
Yep.
And like satirical and aggressive. And so Finger Lace Crown, you know, we went for the exact opposite color. Like I wanted all the colors to be as vivid as possible, you know, and it's a much lighter piece. Not to say that there is an intensity to it, mm-hmm. but it's definitely in that conversation, you know, it's definitely a response to Bitter Taste Ginger in that way. And the color and whatnot, that was all intentional. Like, and, you know, down to, especially in this film, one of my dear friends, very, very talented artist and actor, Steven Nazario, he acts in the film, but he's only in a couple scenes as an actor, but he was there on set almost every day because he was lead makeup artist. And especially lead makeup artist for Therese. And so all the cool eye designs and stuff like that, that really like make her character pop, make her close-ups pop, you know, those are all Steve's designs. And so we wanted that rich color to be in every opportunity, you know, and Steve, especially when we had costume pieces picked out or one of the, you know, I give pretty free rein on costumes a lot of times. Every now and again, I'll have like a very specific vision for one outfit or one scene or like, mm-hmm. but, you know, Sarah Cugini did a lot of the costume work in for the film. And there was one specific look with her and the circular yellow sunglasses was important to me. And then we kind of built around that. So, but yeah, the color pop, that's all Steve. That's all Steve's makeup, especially on Therese. Sarah did a lot of her own makeup, but Steve did it as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah, every inch of it, we wanted it to be just saturated with color.
I didn't mention this in the beginning, but I thought the music was really well done as well, and really kind of helped set the tone for a lot of the scenes.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was
that's
empowering, but it was there. It was just, yeah, I enjoyed that as well.
Yeah, it's different for everybody. You know, one of the comments people have given about it is that the music is overpowering. And I'm like, well, that's the purpose at times. Like, and I'm glad you disagree. I don't agree with it either, but like for some people it has been.
No.
There's almost all that music is done by one gentleman. There's two or three tracks in it that that we paid for, paid the rights to have through Epidemic Sound.
Okay.
However, most of it is all done by a gentleman named Ryan Lutton. And the beautiful thing specifically about the music for this project is Tyrone, when doing these spray paint pieces, would listen to Ryan Lutton's music. Mm. Ryan Lutton, when he made this music, it's a very improvisational way of working. You can see his videos on YouTube. You can watch him composing these songs in real time and just like creating it on the fly. Wonderful artist. Tyrone would then play these pieces of music while he's making these paintings. And while I was writing the script, I was listening to Ryan's music, you know, and like absorbing that, knowing that like, okay, well, there's like here again, talking about lineage, like there's something here, right, that connects. And like, I write in a very improvisational way a lot of times. Like I don't write being like, this is what's going to happen next. This is what, you know, I introduce myself to the characters. I get to know them for a while. And then when pen hits the page or fingers hit the keys, you know, I let them do a lot of the talking. I let them tell me what they're trying to say. Not always, but oftentimes that's where it's the real good stuff is usually happening.
Right.
And then, you know, while listening to this music and then being able to use that music in the actual film, editing to the music sometimes, other times already having the scene edited and being like, all right, which one of Ryan's pieces can work here, you know? And the fact that he was so like open and loving and willing to let us use his work. He's the only person on the entire team who isn't Lehigh Valley based. He's actually in London. And he's the, I've never met Ryan in person. We've only ever communicated via Facebook or email or things like that.
Seen the film.
But yeah, his work is amazing.
Has he seen the finished film?
That's a question for Ryan. I mean, he's definitely not seen it in a theater. We did screen in London. And I told him about it, and I think he had some kind of project or thing that he was going to be away when that was happening. I've given him links and stuff to watch it. But I think he knows that, like, oh, the way to experience this for the first time really would have been with an audience if I could possibly do it. And I think he was holding out for that. You'd have to ask him. I can't say for sure. But I know that he knows the movie's coming out now on December 5th, or depending on when this releases, I guess, is out on Amazon, and it's going to be available in the UK, which is the first thing that he asked me. So I think he's excited to, just as excited as we are, for it to finally actually be out there.
Right, right. That's cool. Yeah. I just love that you have your ensemble that you use. I think that's really cool. I like that aspect of what you're doing, keeping it tight.
Thanks.
And using people that, they're talented, but it's like, you know, you have people that you can kind of bring in, and kind of cast. I think that's really special that you do that.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, some of the folks I've been working with and I've known since college. I mean, in the case of this film, Joshua Fatoros, you know, is one of my dearest friends. And again, he plays Baby. He's one of the producers. And Elizabeth Shumway, who plays his sister in the movie, another person that we went to college with, another amazing actress. Maria Sole, who plays the woman who buys the painting in the beginning, is one of the first relationships in the movie with Lemon Drop, mm-hmm. Plays Simone. And then Steve, again, went to college with Steve. Like, some of those folks, it's been that long. In other cases, like in the case of Felicia, it's been like the last 6 years, 6-7 years now at this point. And Therese, same thing, about 6-7 years. Sarah Cugini, about 6-8, something like that, about the same amount of time. And they're my regular players, you know.
That would really help on set when you're creating, when you're working, right? The
sometimes, yeah,
you can kind of develop with people, you know, that you can when you have close relationships like that, would make your job
absolutely
easier. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, sometimes it's the leading role, sometimes it's a supporting role. Like, it's different with each project. And I do write oftentimes with specific people in mind. And in the case of Finger Lace Crown, Sierra Saka, she plays Hazel in the film, the girlfriend of Josh's character. And she is in the scenes in Finger Lace Crown 3 or 4, whatever it is. And she's the lead in the one we just finished shooting at the beginning of this year, Clench, which was a huge project. And was also the first time that I did the process a little bit differently. Like, normally I'll write for specifically people and then cast others into the roles. For that one, instead, I put out an open casting call, and all of my regular players, all they needed to do was send in a video saying, ready to do another one. Like, they didn't really have to audition. They just had to put their foot in the door. And everyone, or they could show me something new. If they wanted to put in an audition, they could. From there, I wrote roles specifically for people that were auditioned, just based on what the film was going to be about, and like bringing in like, ooh, I like this energy. And it's the first time I kind of like went about it that way. And to, as far as the piece goes, to great effect. Like, it's an incredibly powerful film. But it was definitely a much different way of working. I don't know if it's one that I'm going to go to anytime soon. It's definitely a difficult way of going about it when you don't have any money. You know, it might be different if it were like, hey, I have $1 million to make this movie. I don't know what it's going to be yet. Come and audition. See my past work. Am I someone you'd want to work with? Great. Well, we're going to figure out what it is, you know?
Right.
But I mean, all projects, when you're, you know, when you're not working with real money, when you can't, and when I say no budget, we've had some money. And by had some money, I mean like $100 here, $1,000 here. We raised a little bit of funds here. But having a budget's a different thing. We've never had any, like not even $10,000. But if I had $10,000 in my hand at one time, then I could make a budget for my movie with $10,000. We've never had a budget. I've always dreamed of having a budget, even if it's small, just because of like part of my brain really responds well to that kind of organization. But when you're working on this kind of independent level, every aspect of what you're creating needs to be malleable, needs to be organic, needs to be you as a, that's another thing I would tell young creatives is every single thing, everything, like you might think not everything. I mean, every single thing, you have to be prepared to let it bend, move. You know, the more rigid you try to be with something, it's just going to all fall apart.
Yep.
The more rigid you want to be. And you just gotta, you gotta be prepared to let it move. Our teacher, Norman Roberts, in theater, called it the formless hunch. He didn't call it that. He taught us that from, I believe it was Peter Brook, the theater director, talked about the formless hunch. And it was a beautiful lesson that I wasn't ready to hear as an actor or as a creative, because it's like, well, no, I have a vision and that's what I want to do. If you keep it malleable, if you keep it, if you have that I know what this is trying to say, I know what I'm trying to say with it, and that's what you inspire others with. You have a vision, but you're ready to like move with it. You're ready to like flow with it.
Right. Well, one of the biggest things for creativity to show up is constraints. When you have constraints, that's when creativity goes to work. You know what I mean? It's what you're kind of just saying.
I do.
Yeah.
Do
you ever have a, do you know of a moment where you were shooting something kind of to your point or what you're talking about and something happened unexpectedly that you just like did not think of that it would happen, but it happened and you kind of rolled with it and it kind of turned out to be almost exactly what maybe the scene needed? That experience ever happened to you?
Definitely. I mean, it happens regularly. I mean, you keep yourself open to that very thing. Mm-hmm. But I remember one of the first times it happened because I was so frustrated we couldn't do something that I was picturing in my head. And it was on a film. This was back in 2016. We were working on a film called Binge Purge with our mutual friend in it, Kate Hughes.
Mm.
This scene had a woman named Valen Turkovich, who I worked with on several films. We were working this scene where it was a film about a person who was bulimic, and it was with her family, and none of the men were ever shown on screen. So it was just the back of her dad's head and her mom, and they were both berating her because she just recently got fired. And we never find out why, where this started, why it started initially, you know, her going through the binging and purging cycle. But we get hints of it. And in this scene, she's at the dinner table and her parents are arguing at each other. They're arguing at her. The mom is belittling her about losing the job. The dad is defending her and being like, no, it's okay. Like, you know, don't beat her up. You know, and it's just like constant mixed messages. Am I in trouble? Am I okay? Is it okay? Is it not okay? Like the dad is yelling at the mom at one point, and the whole time Valen, her character Valerie, is just stuffing her face with the food and just like carving into this food. It's this really intense moment. It came out really, really well. Anyway, so she's like devouring this food. And the dad's like, don't eat like that. The mother's like, it's gross. And then, but they're having like multiple arguments at one time. And finally, the dad like screams at the mother at the top of his lungs to just shut up then. And then focuses in on the daughter alone and is just like really laying down the law. Do not eat like that. And she's a grown woman. you know, also, like, that should be mentioned. It's 30s, early, late 20s, and just really laying into her to not eat like that. And she's just, like, locking eyes back with him. She only looks down briefly to put more food in her mouth. And she just keeps stuffing her mouth. And we were in somebody's home. You know, someone let us use their space to shoot this scene. In my head, the button of the scene was her spitting the food across the table and storming off. That just wasn't a reality. It just could not happen. This was someone's home. You know, that's someone's actual kitchen table. That's mm-hmm. someone's actual floor. The people that own the home are lovingly letting us use it. You know, we're just some people's home. Like, now as a filmmaker, like, I've been in a lot of homes. Some people would be like, yeah, as long as you clean up, I don't care. You know, that's fine. But this was not the case here. We talked about, all right, we're going to have to bring the plate up and spit it out that way. And Valen had just magic. The one take, this is happening, and she just opens her mouth. And, like, suddenly food is there. Like, it's just like a magic trick. Like, it goes from there's nothing there to just like a wad of food that she just lets fall out of her mouth while making, like, dead eye contact with him. And it's just, like, such a disgusting but powerful beat. That was just so, like, the last choice you would think
right,
to make.
Right, right, right. Like, but yet, he's the best choice.
It was like no one else would have done that. No other film would have done that. Why? Because they would have had a budget and they would have gone with choice one, which was spitting the food across the table, which, mind you, might have looked great. Probably visually would have been great and would have been a powerful beat. But it would not have been as unique a powerful beat as what we ended up with. For that very reason.
I love those kinds of moments.
Yeah. And that's what you're hunting for. You know, you set up an environment where hopefully you can bring in some of those kind of things.
In which order should I watch the rest of your movies? I'm going to write this
up.
Because you know how you said, like, you know, heavy, I started with Finger Lace Crown. So what would I watch next?
Oof. Well, if you were serious about watching all of them, I would watch I would go back to Macy on a Good Day and then watch them in order.
Okay.
I would watch Macy on a Good Day. Then I would watch Binge Purge, which is only 40 minutes.
Okay.
A Hole to China.
A Hole to China. Okay.
Yep. And then I would watch The Ground That Sinks.
Okay.
Binge Purge, A Hole to China, and The Ground That Sinks. Were the three films back-to-back that I worked with Valen, where she was the lead. So that was kind of like its own little, like, mini era, right?
Yeah.
And then from there, you've got The Worry Doll, which is the next feature.
Okay.
And then from there, if you really want to hunker down, we did a five-hour limited series called The Price of Fairy Tales. You could give that a watch if you wanted. That's on Amazon. Okay. But that one, again, like, that one, equipment, sound quality. So it's not usually what I lead with, but the performances, both of Sid Stauffer, Jenna McBreen, phenomenal.
Okay.
And it's such an underseen piece of our work because it's 5 hours long and it's very depressing. But, and I'm so bummed about that because everybody's performance is great. I'm very proud of the writing. Mm-hmm. Production side, it's like we've only gotten better. But I can't say enough just how amazing everybody in that, and Jenna is the lead of that, and her performance is so heartbreaking and so powerful, and she gave so much of herself to it, like gave so much of her own experience to it. And, you know, as an artist, my regrets end up being in things like, I've wanted better equipment for so long. I've put myself into so much debt to be able to never again be in a position where I have to fault the equipment.
Mm.
And I spent so many years being like, oh, I'm so proud of this. And like, but the equipment, like, it's, and of all of them, Price of Fairy Tales suffers the most from that. Mm. And of all the people I've worked with, Jenna got caught the brunt of that. The period where my equipment did not match our goals. And because it's a depressing piece, but it was meant to be, you know, like, tragedy is meant to be, you know, you know, it's criminally underseen. And if for nothing else, I would have people watching it for just how towering of a performance she gives. Like, truly powerful. And then from there, it's Bitter Taste of Ginger, which I've mentioned several times here. Then Finger Lace Crown. And then what we have coming up is Clench. And then I could give you 15 short films that we made. You know, it's, it'd probably be easier to email you a list.
Okay, we could do that. But this is a good start.
Yeah.
But I do
definitely, like,
in all seriousness, I really enjoyed Finger Lace Crown so much. Like, I was,
thank you, Bill,
immersed. Like, I, the visuals, the right, it just all worked for me. Like, I loved it. I just, all of it, there was nothing I would say. I mean, I love character studies, and I love that, you know, things that slow down so you can, you know, we're just so fast paced anymore. You know, everything's just like, I love when like scenes can develop, you know, on their own, and just the visuals and the way you crafted the story and the music, and just beautiful, beautiful job. I would highly recommend everybody go see this movie when they can. I just have one question. What's a Finger Lace Crown?
Mm. Oh, yeah. So as you know, at the end of the movie, one of the few people from the cast and team that I didn't mention was Lisa Wachowski. Mm-hmm. And Lisa is awesome. Lisa was going to be our ASL consultant on a project that we didn't end up getting to create, which was very unfortunate. It was going to be what was going to be the project after Bitter Taste of Ginger. And when that fell through, I was like, oh, I've spent a year studying sign language with Lisa, that several cast members have spent this year studying with Lisa. And I was like, well, 100% Lisa's going to be involved in this. So I ended up creating this piece where at the end of it, Lisa signs this poem.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And in it, it mentions the Finger Lace Crown, thus the title. And so part of me doesn't want to give it away, but it's like, because it's poetry, but there's plenty in this movie that people can mull over, and I can answer one little one like that. Finger Lace Crown is the one of the lines in it is, I don't remember the exact line, it's not my job to memorize my poetry, about like laying in repose. And she says something to the effect of like a finger lace crown. And so when you lace your fingers together like this, yeah, and you lay back and you take in life, you take in the world. And so that finger lace crown is that action of laying in repose with your fingers interlaced, cradling your own head.
Okay. You know what's interesting?
Yeah.
When I come up with a big idea, me, in my life, for my work, that's what I do. I did not.
Is it?
Yeah. I put my feet up on the desk, and I make that, I do that. And I lean back with a sketchbook at my lap. Wow.
Yeah, well, there it is. Yeah, powerful.
I think that's the note we have to end on.
Yeah, I love it.
Brandon, congratulations on the movie, the film. It's awesome. I'm going to be watching you and as it kind of moves out into, you know, where it's going to go and how it's going to find its audience. And I wish you all the best with that. It's a phenomenal piece of work, man. Really. Bravo.
Thank you.
Keep doing your thing, man. I'll be watching.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Be well, my friend.
All right, Ad Yakkers. Hope you enjoyed it, because we have many more great conversations planned and guests lined up ready to yak it up. Ad Yak is sponsored and produced by ASR Media. Theme song was written and performed by Dan Ross. Ad Yak is the official podcast of the AAF Greater Lehigh Valley Ad Club. Stay hungry, stay humble. Till next time.
This episode of Ad Yak is rated O for, oh man, that was good.